Today we are excited to talk to Viz expert at Voice and Sport, Paige Roberts, a sports psychotherapist, athlete mental health advocate, and a peak performance expert. Paige specializes in helping athletes overcome performance anxiety, recover fully from sports injuries or failures, and rebound from performance slumps. As a high school and collegiate athlete herself, Paige faced numerous challenges, including overuse injuries, an eating disorder, and multiple concussions. Today, Paige shares the neuroscience behind overcoming all of them and dives deep into the technique she uses called performance neurotraining. Performance neurotraining is a combination of sports psychology, brain spotting, and hot and cold photobiomodulation laser light therapy. This draws upon techniques from clinical, social work, exercise, and neuroscience, along with health and wellness lifestyle coaching.
When I have the athletes come in person, is we scan their brain with a QEEG to actually see that there's some neurodepression, and we see that their audiovisual and physical reaction time has decreased.
Paige also shares how she overcame challenges like binge drinking, an injury-derived marijuana addiction, and death by suicide of some of her closest friends.
It was a difficult challenge at the time, but getting off of not drinking anymore and utilizing marijuana to sleep, and really the trauma reprocessing therapy actually helped the sleep issue.
And finally, Paige dives deep into how overtraining and concussions can lead to trauma responses in the body.
Whether it's a physical injury or a loss of a loved one, that's all ramping up our nervous system. And then the overtraining aspect of things. So if you're in this chronic cortisol stress state, your body's going through a lot of trauma.
Because we are discussing eating disorders, suicide, and addictions today, we want anyone listening to know that if you or someone in your life is struggling with mental health challenges, you can reach out to a mental health resource like a counselor, doctor, or an expert on the Voice and Sport platform. Please know that you are not alone, and you can call the 988 Lifeline 24 hours a day. Before we get started, if you love this podcast, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and join our community at Voice and Sport to unlock the entire episode in this conversation with Paige. Paige, welcome to the Voice and Sport podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Well, you have this incredible expertise in performance neurotraining, and it's really incredible what you're now doing with athletes. And so we're so excited to kind of learn about like how you got here in the first place into this field, and then what specifically all athletes can learn from you about how to deal with trauma. So really excited to have you here, but I really want to start with the beginning. Let's go back to where you grew up in small Colorado, Rocky Mountain city, and you were immersed in sport at a very young age. I think you did everything from like rafting to skiing to snowmobiling to swimming and running, eventually ending up, you know, in cross country running at college. But let's go back to your childhood. Like, what sports did you really get into, and what were some of those big lessons that you learned from your time in sport?
Yeah, the first sport would probably have been skiing. So growing up in the mountains in Colorado, it's just super common for families to ski. And so I started skiing, then we started like rafting as a family, and I always loved to run. I would chase my brother on his bike. The love of sport started there. And then I, of course, did the traditional t-ball, softball, gosh, volleyball, basketball, track, whether mid-distance, distance. And then when I got into high school, I started running and swimming. And I really enjoyed the endurance sports. I have a lot of slow twitch muscle fibers, so that was kind of where I excelled. And really, you know, with the running, though, it was very devastating because I had a coach who, he was not very trained, and so he was having us, all of us, run too much, and we all started getting stress fractures and was advising us that we needed to be a certain weight to run. And so that started this whole cascade of an eating disorder, of restricting food and being very mindful about only eating fat-free milk and cereal. And that was very devastating that I ended up getting the stress fractures that were breaking through. I qualified for state at a very young age with the mile and the 2 mile, and of course with cross country. And we actually won state in cross country, and we were very good. Growing up where I did, we were the optimal elevation for training for running. So it was about 7,000 feet. And so I really loved it, but I was in such pain. It was became like a love-hate kind of thing. And then towards the end of my high school career, we were headed to our first swim meet, and it was very icy roads in the mountains, and our bus driver swerved from hitting a deer, and we did a 360 and went off an embankment and rolled. And so at that time here, I was had a concussion and tore all the muscles in my shoulder and was really told I would never swim again. And that was very difficult as well. And so then when I went on to college, I was apprehensive about running again because my legs were still pretty sore. I had a lot of, you know, like the stress fractures had not completely healed, but I made contact with my advisor, who I was studying exercise science, and he told me that there was a way to cross train and that he really wanted to have me on the team based off of my running stats. And so I was able to cross train, which meant, you know, about 2 to 3 times more training than average. And I was able to compete, and that was a great experience. And that's when I really learned that there are PhDs in coaching and physiology, and that it really does make a difference. And had I had a coach that was highly educated, much of what had gone on in the hurts and the pains and the broken bones would have never happened. So it was a huge lesson for me, and really what got me into the exercise science and then into the sports psychology world.
Well, I think you just mentioned so many unfortunate examples of what young women go through in their early careers in sport. And that is really why we've developed this podcast as well as the platform, right? Is to hopefully prevent some of those things from happening. So I want to go back a little bit to your high school days and just talk about, you know, the not specifically the coach that you had, but when you are dealing with a coach who might not be informed about the physiology of our bodies, or, you know, the understanding of how to really think about training and fueling your body, this unfortunately is still happening today. So there's a lot of young girls who, you know, are not fully equipped or have the right support system. So if you could go back in time and whisper a few things to that coach, you know, what would you whisper to that coach?
Well, my science mind went right away to like, give us the peer-reviewed studies. I want to know that we need to be 120 pounds. Like, this is ridiculous. As well as, you know, bring in a nutritionist, bring in an expert who can inform us and can give us that insight if you don't feel that you have that. Yeah, that would be the most part.
And what would you whisper to your younger self at that point, you know?
Oh, my younger self. Oh, gosh. Tune into your body. Pain is a signal something's not right. We don't get pain unless there is severe stress on our body. And we're not talking just like pain within competing or performing. It's the pain of like 5 days in a row, your legs are throbbing and you can't walk. It's that kind of delayed onset muscle soreness that's going on over 72 hours. So that's certainly something I'm persistently telling my athletes at this point in time. It's like, wow, if you're in that intense pain at that moment, there's no way that you can perform or compete effectively, as well as if you're doing a, you know, aerial sport of some kind, that can actually signal your body to break down in form and you can actually hurt yourself. So it's that whole pain is a signal something's not right. You need to tune into your body. We need as much recovery as we do the training time.
So that old saying, like, no pain, no gain, that's not really one of your mantras.
In the moment, you know, we really talk about our lactate threshold and lactate hydronate levels. And so, yes, there's that persistent burning when you're in a race or when you're competing and you're pushing through that. And that's an amazing feeling. But it's thereafter. How many days are you in throbby pain? You know, every time you move, do you hurt? Like, all of those things are just not okay.
Yeah. So what advice do you give athletes now to make sure that they're not, you know, being overworked or overtrained, especially in those younger years, because it can lead to burnout, not just like the physical implications of overtraining, but also the mental implications. So what advice do you give to like those younger athletes today that are in high school that, you know, they're competitive, they want to get to college, they want to get into that top spot, but at the end of the day, you do need to take breaks and you do need to rest?
Well, in the fun aspect of things, you know, sports are supposed to be fun. If you're not having fun anymore, we need to check in and see what's going on. And then there's just that other aspect of, you know, having a social life and having a life. I find a lot with athletes these days, they're just going to, you know, tournament after tournament. They go directly from their high school team to their club team and all of these things. And it's just really not healthy. So I think that I see nowadays with how many tournaments and camps and conditioning things that these kids are just not having a personal life. So there needs to be that downtime as well. In addition to, like, yeah, after the 72 hours, are you still sore? Okay, you need another day of rest, and you do not get back out there until you're not in pain anymore.
Well, I love your background because it's so interesting. Your undergraduate years in college, you studied exercise science, but then you went on to get your master's in social work and then a doctorate of internal medicine in Hawaii. Did you already always have this master plan? Or it sounded like you started out in exercise science. You were personally dealing with your own concussion syndrome from, you know, back in high school. And then that led you down this other path. And I'm just curious to know, like, how did you get here?
So what I had uncovered was that I'd started drinking alcohol when a friend who had been a college football player and he had completed suicide. So that's when I was 19 and he was 20. And I didn't realize that I had started drinking in excess. What people would say was normal for college kids to binge drink, but I hadn't realized that I'd started binge drinking after he had died. And so that was really interesting for me to kind of put two and two together during the process of this trauma reprocessing therapy. And then I started realizing, like, oh my gosh, like, I have been drinking to forget. I'd been drinking to stuff that sadness and that grief. And then I started realizing I was using marijuana to sleep from the post-concussion syndrome stuff, because that's right when I started in high school was I started utilizing that to sleep. And I really remember the point when I decided that I would use marijuana for the pain and the concussion piece, because the doctors kept giving me, because, you know, I'm 38 years old. And at the time, the doctors gave all of us so many opiates. And I remember when I was in high school feeling like if I took another opiate, I would die. Like, I felt like my respiration rate was going down. And so that was terrifying for me. So I started for the pain and for the sleep using marijuana. And so here I was at 23 going through this trauma reprocessing therapy, which I thought I was just going kind of to him to be like, hey, what's my next step? What should I be doing? I know you've worked with athletes forever. And then started learning about myself and some of my own habitual resourcing behaviors and things that I'd started doing to make myself okay mentally and physically, essentially. And so it was a difficult challenge at the time, but getting off of not drinking anymore and utilizing marijuana to sleep. And really the trauma reprocessing therapy actually helped the sleep issue. And now I know that 80% of concussions have the sleep issue. And back then they had no idea. Like, I'd went to a couple experts and been like, oh my gosh, why can't I sleep? They'd given me medications that just didn't work. And it was really my nervous system was on a hypervigilant, you know, nervous system state, and it wasn't able to calm down. And then starting to realize too, the chronic pain from the stress fractures and all of that, and the shoulder injury and neck and everything from the school bus wreck, all of that was contributing to ramping up my nervous system to that fight, flight, freeze all the time. And my body wasn't really able to drop into the parasympathetic and actually heal and recover. So it was all this kind of like whirlwind that year of kind of figuring out and healing and what my next step was going to be. So then I got experience working for the Department of Human Services to get into the Master's of Social Work program at Colorado State University. And I did that. And it was an excellent experience. I really liked social work. I liked the advocacy piece. And I did a program that was both the nonprofit management and the clinical. So it's the advanced generalist. So I was able to kind of see both how, gosh, these organizations can either serve their clients well or not. And that being organizations or anything. And so in my community in Steamboat Springs, there were lots of nonprofit, you know, sports organizations, a very big one there. And so could really see some of the kinks in their systems and thought, well, but if you can clinically sit with someone and improve them, you can actually desensitize them kind of to these kinks in these systems that aren't great. And so I decided to go towards that path. And right as I was getting ready to launch my business and doing all that and breaking away from, you know, the individual who'd helped me heal and I was going to be his competition now, I'd had another friend. I'd taught skiing on the mountain in Steamboat Springs and he was younger and he'd just gotten done at Metropolitan State University and he completed suicide in the same way. So that was like 10 years later. And I was like, okay, what's going on here? And so that kind of shifted me into an even deeper dive of understanding trauma, the concussion piece. That was about 10 years ago. So it was right when the NFL was going through its concussion litigation and kind of seeing that, hey, long-term effects do come from these concussions. And so some of these experts, Dr. Jeffrey Kuchar, he's the psychiatrist for the US ski team and for the NFL Players Association, NBA Players Association. And he also created this whole wing of the American Academy of Neurology around sports concussions. So pulling together some of the top neurologists and psychiatrists and neuropsychologists in the country and even world at this point in time in creating real protocols and what these symptoms are looking like and what we can do to keep individuals from having this tau buildup CTE in their brains. So that got me on this whole path of like, okay, so we know it's trauma, but what do we do after these traumas happen?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you have been through so many personal experiences yourself, whether that's battling addictions or surviving abusive relationships, surviving concussions yourself, experiencing loss, of which you mentioned. And I think I just want to take a pause for a minute and say, like, how do you persevere through moments that when you have these tough experiences, because you're not alone. A lot of people go through unfortunate situations in sport and life. So what's your approach now from, like, you know, more from the perspective of now after all of your studies, how do you get through those tough experiences and that trauma?
So, and that's kind of, you know, you mentioned the abusive relationship. So when I was working at the hospital, I had started dating. He was a past college athlete and was just graduating and very reactive, very abusive, lots of concussions. He was a rugby player and lacrosse player, the goalie. Thought taking the hits. I mean, he enjoyed it. He would get very violent and be physically abusive. And then you would try to be like, hey, what happened? And he was like really blacking out when it was going on. And so when I was doing the healing and going through the trauma reprocessing, that's when I started to really realize, like, oh my gosh, you know, like, I need to get out of this relationship. This is not good. And so from there, it really started to get me to realize that, okay, you have to do the work for one, because I was very not mindful of even what was going on in my own life and what was, like I said, the drivers to the addiction, why I was attracted to this individual, why I guess I thought on some level that I needed to be treated badly. And some of that really came from just, you know, I hadn't had all male coaches that were very controlling. And so, and then even in some of my undergrad studies, aside from my beloved cross-country coach and the exercise physiologist, some of the other males were kind of the same way. So it was this, you know, you kind of had to please and appease. And so all of this kind of culminating together and realizing, like, hey, we need to be doing the work. And so at this point, I still do brain spotting sessions with a therapist twice a month because I have to keep my nervous system clean and I have to make sure that I'm very aware of why I'm doing what I'm doing. I don't want to slip into any habitual resourcing patterns. I don't want to slip into any appeasing and pleasing other people and denying my own needs and what's good for me. So that's kind of, you know, where it all started. And then from there on, it was even just reaching for even more modalities and more techniques to really help the nervous system be at its optimal performance. And there was another thing that I realized too within the psychology world was that not everyone did do sessions on themselves. And I kind of saw that in graduate school. And when my professors were asking, like, oh, who's done therapy? Who's done this? Like, there were only like three people who raised their hand. And I'm like, this is interesting. Like, so I was always in this frame of like, hey, you know, it's like, I'm very open about what's gone on in my life, because how can I sit here and expect someone to be very vulnerable with me and to be very honest and upfront if I am not myself? And then there's some debate around that with this transference and when do you share with clients and so on. So it's not that you just tell them everything, but if it's a similar scenario, you can certainly help an individual feel that, hey, you're not alone in this. Hey, no one's judging you. Hey, these are common things that go on. And then they can heal. So it's, you know, that's where I really got to, is just like, oh my gosh, we need to be constantly doing work all the time to best be serving our clients and to make sure that we're living in alignment with what we're telling others that they should be doing.
Well, let's break down some of those techniques that you use. Mm. I mean, you use a process called performance neurotraining, which is a combination of sports psychology, brain spotting, and hot and cold photobiomodulation, laser light.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those techniques, because I think what your clinical social work and your exercise and neuroscience background, along with just in general, all the experiences that you have had, it puts you in a really unique position, I think about how you treat people, how you treat athletes that go through trauma. So I want to start just like think at like the highest level, like what is considered trauma?
Well, trauma is just stress on the nervous system that can get us into that fight, flight, freeze, or that fetal position. Oh no, just heart racing, fingers being numb, legs shaking. And so when you're talking to individuals about, they're like, oh yeah, I get that when I drive. It's like, yeah, okay, that's not healthy. We don't want you going that high on your nervous system. So really we have two ends of our nervous system. And so the top being the sympathetic. So that's our fight, flight, freeze. That's our beta gamma brainwave. That's really high on alert. And then the bottom is the parasympathetic. And so that's where our DHEA is produced. And so that our hormones stay in balance and that we're actually recovering appropriately and that we're not always in cortisol, that those other hormones are present. So when we talk about trauma, we talk about any negative experience in the nervous system, mental or physical. Our body doesn't know how to discern between the two. Dr. Robert Scar, he's an MD neurologist and he's recently passed, which is very sad, but he ran this brain injury clinic in Boulder, Colorado for 20 years. And he started talking about how the body discerns and what's going on with the body with trauma. And that's where he started seeing a lot of sticking points with individuals with their recovery, whether it be brain injury or physical injury or emotional injury. And he said that, you know, we don't know how to discern between the two and we store them the same way. And then we reset our homeostasis based off of that trauma or stressor, right? So every single time we go through something, our nervous system just continues to get to a higher and higher hypervigilant fight, flight, freeze homeostasis. And it doesn't just go back on its own. So we have to do things to deregulate and calm our nervous system back down, or mentally training our brain to train our nervous system, or vice versa. When we talk about the biofeedback stuff of the belly breaths, smiling to get ourselves out of beta wave. So it was really Dr. Robert Scar that got me like pushed in this direction of really understanding trauma and what it's doing to the nervous system and what this starts to show up as. Because when we're in that fight, flight, freeze area, that's going to be the freeze is kind of that disassociative depression flat effect. And then we've got the fight and the flight, which is going to be that anxiety and kind of seeing red or disassociating when we are out there playing and we don't even remember how we did things, but we knew that we were in this like really activated state. And so, yeah, so that's kind of the trauma, what goes on with our nervous system. But when we're talking about just normal stressors in our life, gosh, it's a car cutting us off. It's seeing other trauma as well. So this is something that's been fairly new that we're understanding. And what they're doing is they're hooking up multiple people to QEEGs and watching brain activity. But when one individual is experiencing a negative experience, or they see like a gymnast or something, if they went and did the vault and they fell, every individual that's watching them, the same areas in their brain are lighting up and making neural networks. So they are like getting hypervigilant around that potentially happening to them. So all of this, our entire environment is watching others, people go through stuff. So then our body's bracing and preparing for that. And then just experiencing it ourselves, right? So whether it's a physical injury or a loss of a loved one, that's all ramping up our nervous system. And then the overtraining aspect of things. So if you're in this chronic cortisol stress state, your body's going through a lot of trauma with that. So it's constantly just ramped up in a lot of cortisol hypervigilance. And that's where you start to see athletes when they're like, oh my gosh, I've been doing all this recovery time, I've been doing all these things, but my legs feel like cement. It's like, yeah, you're like running really hot on cortisol all the time and your adrenals are pretty taxed. And so that's what got me studying more of the integrative medicine piece, was looking at all these little factors beyond just the physical or the mental and going, okay, well, what's going on with this person? They have like zero estrogen, you know, and then working with other prescribing docs and so on in my area of really teasing things out and getting people to recover. But it really starts with the brain spotting or the trauma reprocessing when it comes to these things, because we have to clear it from the nervous system and get the nervous system to calm down before we can really even start addressing the other pieces or concurrently addressing the other pieces.
So, Paige, you mentioned that, you know, during all of the studies and throughout your college, but then even, even beyond that, you started recognizing things in yourself that you actually had trauma yourself. But here you are studying these areas. And so for you, it was, I would imagine, a little easier to kind of recognize then the trauma that you already have. So how does like the average athlete out there today that's not studying all this every day recognize if they are dealing with trauma? And then what do they do about it?
Well, so the first thing is going to be not sleeping very well. Your performance starts to decline. You don't recover as quickly. Experiencing trauma can be anything that you are really ruminating on and hyperfixated on. So when you're talking to clients and they're telling you like, oh my gosh, I couldn't sleep last night. I was just so worried about the game and this. I was worried about the coach, this. And you're like, oh my gosh, like you are literally up in this beta sympathetic. You are experiencing this high level of stress and trauma right now. When you look at an individual and they sit there and tell you that, oh yeah, my dad left when I was younger. That's very traumatic on the young nervous system. So we really want to, when we're working with individuals, get a very detailed trauma history or life history. And that's just in general, obviously, with this, you know, psych world. But nonetheless, we really need to know about all those pieces because every single one of those things has gotten the athlete where they are right now and experiencing whether they might be like a mental illness symptom at this point in time, where it's depression or anxiety or some OCD kinds of behavior sometimes become very habitually like resourcing patterns because you're trying to distract from the anxiety or the worry or the upset or the sadness. I will see individuals typically, they don't really know completely that they have symptoms. They just know that they don't physiologically feel right, or they know that they're very tired, or they know that they're not loving the game anymore, or they're just not motivated. It's only after a couple sessions that I will start to see an individual be like, yeah, I was depressed. Wow, I didn't even realize that. And what's great, you know, when I have the athletes come in person is we scan their brain with a QEEG to actually see that there's some neurodepression and we see that their audio, visual, and physical reaction time has decreased. And so it's really validating that like, oh yeah, I have been depressed because I have neurodepression. It's like, yeah, when your brain and body goes through injury, it's a lot of energy to heal and recover. So we go down to a more depressed state and the body's preserving its energy. So getting to have that piece was amazing as well. And I integrated that in about 6 years ago of really being able to show people like, look, your voltage in your brain has gone up and your audio, visual, and physical reaction time has gone up, which is everything, of course. And that's just how quickly every region of your brain is responding to any stimulus. So, you know, when I see an individual and it's oftentimes the parents are calling me, even if their child's in their 20s, and they're talking about like, wow, they're standing out on the field. The coach is talking to them. They're wide-eyed. They're not even taking in what they're saying. It's like, yeah, they're kind of in a frozen state, or, you know, they're having breakdowns, you know, panic attacks, like, you know, all this languaging for just nervous system dysregulation. I'm like, oh yeah, well, that's, you're at your max. You're in that sympathetic and you finally have to release and expulse and then cry and come down because this is too much. You can't hang out there too long. It's so uncomfortable. So when you start to hear those kinds of things, and then of course the I don't even know if they like it anymore. They're thinking about retiring, or they're not happy, or they don't like their coach. And you're like, well, let's start digging into things and see why. And sometimes, you know, when you're working with coaches and stuff, when we talk about trauma, it's like my past cross-country coach. Like I didn't even, you know, at the time I was one where I was like, oh, crying's weakness leaving the body. Oh, resilience. Oh, you just keep pushing like most athletes. And so really recognizing and looking back on going like, wow, this guy really set me up. You know, I was listening to him but this was all traumatic on me. Him telling us we were fat, him telling us all those things were traumatic. So going back and having those feelings about that. So when you're looking at an athlete's history with coaches, they may not like their current coach, but what has gone on with all the other coaches? You know, have there been things that we need to clear and release from past coaches to allow for the connection, the comradeship, and all the pieces that need to happen with their current coach?
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing is like really the experience or the journey of the athlete as a person, and that it's all kind of connected. Because yeah. Obviously, like sometimes you can feel sad or depressed or just not right, but you just don't know why. And that's like, oftentimes right. Why it's so important to go and work with somebody like you to talk about it. And I guess for those that haven't ever taken that step to go and talk to you, can you just describe the first initial visit, you know, so that you can maybe share with some of the young women that are out there that might be sitting there listening to this podcast and saying, you know, I just don't feel right, but I don't know what to do about it. And what does this even look like if I tried to do something about it?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I send a big packet to individuals because I do want to have as much detail as possible. So I have a lot of questions outlined and I have some examples of what these things can look like. Like I said, the overtraining, the injuries, past injuries in whatever sport, or in even just leisure activities. You know, so often I will have individuals that have depression and there was no concussion. There weren't a lot of things within their sport and their daily life. And then all of a sudden we find, oh, you crashed on the jet ski going 30 miles an hour. And oh, wow, the symptoms kind of started then at 13. And here you are 17 sitting in front of me. So it's really important, like I said, to get a detailed list. So I ask individuals to tell me every little bad, sad thing that's ever happened to them so that we can go back through those things and fully feel those emotions that got stuck. Because in our society, and I'm telling my athletes these kinds of things, in our society, we really celebrate positive experiences and positive emotions, and they're okay. You're allowed to run out there after you've won and be like, yes, I won, and this is amazing, and everyone's excited about it. But we really stuff the negative emotions. And so the negative emotions, when we stuff them instantly and don't fully process them, that's what creates the dysregulation, and then there's no resolve. So I have them do this really detailed list. And then I have them listen to bilateral binaural sounds, which is kind of like this altered state hypnotherapy aspect of things. Not scary. It's just like waves going back and forth. And then we get online or in office, and then we just literally start going through the trauma memory networks is what we call them. And I will have people start with the worst first or chronologically just going all the way back. So, okay, so tell me about bad, sad things that happened as early back as you can remember, sights, sounds, and smells. Because the thing is, too, is when we take in trauma, it is not a consciously aware action. It actually occurs within our senses. So sights, sounds, and smells. So when we're out there in the moment, if, you know, like a football player getting tackled, they're not consciously making this memory. It's the body's experience. So when we're taking people back into the trauma memory network, I'm going, all right, so you're standing on the football field. And right before it happened, go ahead and tell me what you were doing, what was going on. Do you remember what you were wearing? Do you remember, again, the sights, sounds, and smells? It's like, yeah, I could smell popcorn or this or this. So it's really making sure that all of the unconscious experience, which is our body, that's why we're listening to bilateral sounds, dropping into a deeper level of consciousness, which is kind of that hypnotherapy piece, we're able to access those memories in the body, and we're able to track even where we're holding things in our fascia so that we fully let go of them. Because the emotion that we can identify does have an energetic experience within the body. It's somatic experience, is Dr. Peter Levine's work. So it's really going through that list and me saying, hey, okay, tell me the bicycle accident, sights, sounds, and smells. Well, I was riding here and here and here. And it's like, okay, do you feel this anywhere in your body when you knew when the car hit you or you hit the curb and you knew you were going down? Oh, I kind of feel it in my chest. It's like, yeah, scary. And then what happened? And then we kind of talk about thereafter and then up to the recovery and if there were symptoms for concussion or weren't. And then what was the next thing that happened that was sad and bad? Well, my best friend moved. She left and it made me really sad. It's like, oh, how sad. Well, tell me about you two's relationship and the sad things, you know, that you miss or about that individual. And where do you feel that? It's like, oh, I kind of feel my heart. So it's that kind of allowing for this desirable condition for us to fully process these stuffed emotions and the body's experience to reset that homeostasis.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very therapeutic. I mean, even just you talking about it is making me think about, wow, like my life experiences. And if I was to talk about some of them in a slightly different way, like you said, in an environment where it really like kind of like a controlled environment where you're really trying to think about those, all of those elements coming together, if that would allow me to process things differently. And so is that really where like the brain spotting comes in? And can you explain like, what does that process look like for an athlete?
Yeah. And so that's the thing. We're listening to this bilateral sound going back and forth. It's very slight. It's dropping us into a deeper level of consciousness, that unconscious, the body itself. We find information even, because that's kind of like that hypnotherapy piece. We find information that we didn't even really consciously remember and even be able to put down on the paperwork. Like so often, I will find that there's about four things on the paperwork and then we get about 20 by the third session because we stuff these things down. We don't want to be ruminating on them and thinking about them all the time. So it's allowing for us to find things that maybe we'd forgot about. Maybe we forgot about when we fell off the slide in kindergarten. That impacted us. So it's really interesting when you get someone in that altered state aspect. And then there's also we know the eyes are like everything with the brain. So it's our brain is about 80% visual. And every time we move our eyes from right to left, it's our second cranial nerve. And it like sends energy throughout our entire brain, which sends in energy throughout our entire body. So we manipulate the visual path. And so it was really started with EMDR, so eye movement desensitization reprocessing. But what we'll have individuals do is literally take a pencil or pointer themselves and, okay, I want you to think about when you lost the race. It was the Olympics. It was terrible. It was so awful for you. So bringing that up in your body. And then we'll have them like find in their visual path where they feel it the most, because it's actually a reflexive cue. So it's the visual piece, it's the bilateral sound, and then it's the somatic piece of accessing where you're feeling these emotions in your body. And a lot of times, like I said, it's going to be in the chest and the gut and, you know, that feeling. Every athlete knows that feeling when their stomach's turning upside down or their chest is tight or their heart's racing before a race. Well, okay, so that's your 12th cranial nerve, your vagus nerve, triggering. It's like going, oh no, we gotta be on high alert here. Something's going to happen. So we're actually deconditioning that vagus nerve's reaction when we are finding where in our body we're holding on to things. And then we're also clearing our visual field, right? So if we are having an athlete, okay, so you got hit when you were running across the field and tackled. So I want you to follow this pointer, because sometimes in office we'll have them follow it. Sometimes I'll have them follow it on the computer screen. And thinking about when you got hit, and we will see a reflexive cue. The eyes, the body will wobble for a moment. So we consider that to be a weakness. So we want to clear the visual field, because if the body did that when we're talking about it here, every time when you look in that direction out on the sports field, that's going to be a weakness in your nervous system. So it's, you know, it's been about almost 15 years that brain spotting's been around, but it's really the combo of hypnotherapy, EMDR, and the somatic experience, and then allowing for focused mindfulness of just seeing what's coming up with either body sensation or accessing that trauma memory network. So it is kind of like a super therapy with the combo of them, but there's still the, you know, dialectical behavior therapy aspect. There's still the cognitive behavior, just our average, I guess, talk therapy modalities integrated in. But really, when you're working with an individual who's never actually done psychotherapy or done any of this, it's like, hey, you throw on the bilateral sound. We just start talking about things. I want to know where you feel them. We're looking at your eyes to get you to be as upset as humanly possible, because we're having you reprocess and desensitize down to a calmer state. So we're kind of talking these things to death and feeling these things to death. So they're no longer really a part of us negatively. So yeah, so that's really the process. But it sounds cumbersome, but no, you just throw on the things and we just start talking and going through it. And I'll joke that I'm trying to make you cry. That's my goal, because we're really changing our physiology at that point and in training that release in that calm point after we get to that high point, so that our nervous system just goes up and down like it should, not staying in the sympathetic all the time.
Well, how many sessions do you need to do, or does it really just vary with athletes in order to really like process and feel like the brain spotting plus the other dimensions that you're mentioning can actually help improve performance or help get them back on the field in a way that's a bit more positive?
Yeah. So about 5 sessions over the last, it's been about 10 years of really studying this and kind of looking at session structure. And I teach other clinicians how to do this, working all across the world. So it's available to everyone. But I see about 5 sessions, I will see an individual have a mental health result. So a lot of mental illness symptoms start to go away. And then at like 10 is where I really see someone that has expanded on their peak performance. So say they were averaging, you know, like 3rd place at a World Cup or at a really high level. And I will see them go on up to the 1st or 2nd point at about that next 5 there. To say that it's always that, you know, we're all very different. But I've really not had a time as of late where it's been more than 10 sessions for results, essentially. And you really think about it, if we're looking at it in that exercise science frame, though, okay, so 10 sessions, 10 weeks. So if we're doing physical therapy, it's the same kind of thing. If we're trying to break down a maladaptive pattern or recover something to get those neural networks no longer being traveled, because what we look at when you look at an athlete too, is that uncontrolled muscle guarding is the body's trauma response when they're out there playing and they're losing their fluid movement and motion.
And so I'll actually see individuals increase shot averages. I'll see individuals, it's the audiovisual physical reaction time piece. I will see them speed up out on the ski hill or running. I will see them being able to kind of drop into the alpha state, which is right above the parasympathetic. That's our flow state. So they'll just be out there not having to think about playing in their sport. They'll actually just be intuitive in that flow, which most of our athletes, unless you're getting a four-year-old as a client, they've been doing these things since they were 4 years old. So they should be able to do these things very unconsciously in their sleep. They know what they're doing out there, but it's that trauma response and that sympathetic beta kind of gamma that keeps individuals from being in that flow. So when we look at the results, it's like they're loving it again. They're energized about it. They're sleeping well. They're not having as intense bouts of the anxiety, because anxiety is like a good thing, right? We want endorphins. But it's how long you're staying up there. It's how intense it is. It's, are you sleeping? Are you not able to play? Are you not able to move? Are you not able to get off the starting block in time? So it's just having those little peaks of that anxiety and then coming back down to that alpha kind of flow state.
Well, let's talk a little bit about concussions, because unfortunately that is a very common injury in a lot of sports. And I'm curious to know just like what your success has been in treating concussions. And again, how do you know, first of all, like, how do you know you have a concussion? And then how does the techniques and the stuff that you're doing actually help athletes get through?
So concussion. So you're going to hit your head, and then at 3 days after, it's going to be the worst of symptoms, right? You don't even have to hit your head, actually. So if you did get slammed into really hard, you're playing field hockey and you go down, but you don't hit your head, but your neck kind of swings back and you feel kind of like, whoa, I got my bell rung, didn't feel great, was a little dizzy after when I stood up, you know, that muffled sound, you're not really hearing things, you're just kind of in this daze. And so that's typically like right away, unless you're knocked unconscious or are repeating yourself or have a pounding headache right away. But at 3 days is when the brain is done essentially dying, right? So you break the little microtubules when you hit your head, and then the acids are seeping into the brain tissue for up to 3 days. And so sometimes, you know, you'll get the individual calling going, oh my gosh, well, I was fine for a couple days. And then man, it hit Monday and she was in the dark room crying, not okay. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of when we see it at its worst within that time frame. But the increased anxiety, the increased depression, the increased like moving to tears, like just like, and then also the sleep piece. And then there's the headache. And then there's nausea. They're looking at screens. They can be kind of blurry and hurt your eyes. The sun is very hard on the eyes. Again, sensory, right? So we're looking at all the senses. So sounds are really overwhelming. Normal sounds that may not have bothered you before, like the air conditioner or the fan or something, it's overwhelming. So the sensory processing piece. So that's kind of what a concussion looks like. And that's in the moment. So we're talking, you should recover in a week to 2 weeks. And if you aren't recovered in about that 2 weeks, you're going into the post-concussion syndrome. And so normally, hey, no contact sports. You could potentially get back out there and do a little bit of exercise as long as you're not going to fall or get ran into. That's actually pretty good for the brain at this point in time. And this is a lot of this protocol is Dr. Mickey Collins out of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And he works with the Steelers and Penguins. He's a neuropsychologist. And so they've come up with a pretty good protocol at this point in time. But we do want the athlete to continue to go back to school. And even if it's in intervals, right? So if it's too overwhelming to be back at school that Monday for, you know, the whole day, let's do like 3 hours. But we do not want an individual sitting in a dark room anymore. We call it the oven. We're like baking in that homeostasis and those symptoms. We want to constantly kind of cognitively and physically challenging the body, but not too much. So really knowing when your symptoms are getting overwhelming again, nope, you need to lay off again. But traditionally, you know, 80% of concussions will heal in that 2 to 3 week timeline. So then after that, if we're looking at post-concussion syndrome, though, I will see individuals that they're not focusing in school anymore. They're not sleeping at night, or they're oversleeping in the morning, not getting to class. They just aren't really caring about things anymore. They're forgetful. Just any brain fog, I think, is one of the biggest things. People start to realize like, hey, I used to be able to do all this stuff, but I'm just so tired. And I just sit here and I just stare. And then, of course, anxiety, depression. So that's how an individual kind of knows. When it comes to what I do, it's like, I want to see someone immediately, right? So then we have the individual come in and we go through the whole concussion experience, isolating both eyes and then both eyes together to make sure we fully process that experience fully. And then the other thing with the concussion piece is we want to do like the pointer close to the eye, because what that's going to do is that sensory piece of triggering that cortisol and then teaching the brain that it can release and relax, that it's not going to hit itself again. And there's some thought on that when people lay down to sleep at night and the head is laying on the pillow and then they can't sleep. We're thinking, oh yeah, because it's a sensory input that, oh my gosh, we don't want to hit our head again. We don't want to hit our head again. Very unconscious. I mean, there's no logic to how the body's responding to trauma, but that's what we would do. And then right away I put photobiomodulation on them. So 20 minutes of these polychromatic light therapy pads, lasers, whatever we want to call them, it's near infrared and red light. And what that's doing is it's allowing for the brain to fully detox. It's decreasing the inflammation because it makes us that bandwidth of that light. It makes us produce nitric oxide, which is an antioxidant. So that combats the cortisol inflammatory free radical. So we're allowing for the brain to get back its nutrients, the blood flow, dumping that 7 grams of tau protein that we need to detox every day that we can't be detoxing if we're inflamed and we're not sleeping. So that really helps with that. And then as of late, some of the studies are really showing us, besides the increase in circulation and the nutrients coming back and the antioxidant piece, it's actually stopping the microglial from overpriming. So the microglial in our brain, they go in and they like clean up. And when the brain gets really inflamed like that, and there's a lot of the tau protein and toxins built up in there, they get overwhelmed. And then they just start kind of attacking the brain. And we call it priming, is when they're attacking and cleaning. So we see this overabundance of priming going on. So the light therapy they're seeing will stop it from priming for a week excessively. So really cool stuff with this photobiomodulation. And so really cool stuff with light therapy. And it's really kind of thinking about it like how we have receptors in our eyes and our skin for serotonin, melatonin production, as well as vitamin D. So that it's just the color that's in the same spectrum of light, but it's just condensed into the red near infrared. So, and then there's also right now they're playing around with green light. I just got a new device, and the green light helps with migraines, but it's also really good with detox because, like I said, we get really backed up with toxins and that can start to impact our mental and physical health. And so it's actually like it puts holes in our adipose tissue cells, and then we dump toxins along with some lipids because most of our adipose tissue is carrying a lot of toxins. And so every time when we're working out and stuff and those toxins are going through our body, they're impacting our brain and causing some neuroinflammation. But really cool stuff with the light therapy. And there's been a lot of research with COVID as of recently with the neuroinflammation piece with the photobiomodulation. And yeah, so pretty cool stuff.
That's really cool. That gives you a lot of hope, I think, for anyone who's listening to this podcast and might be thinking, oh, I've been dealing with trauma or a concussion for years and it hasn't gone away. So would your advice be to not give up and to actually try some of these different techniques?
Yeah, absolutely. Try these techniques. And we've got audiovisual entrainment too, which is also lights and sounds. You wear these funny glasses with like thudding headphones on. And so we know that that also cues back up certain regions of our brain, particularly our HPA axis. So we talk about with trauma and concussions and all of that, that we can offset and mess up our glandular system. So we do, we get very dominant in just our adrenals and we stop actually using our other glands as we are supposed to. So we've seen in QEEGs that those are flatlined, those channels of those glands. And so literally just with like one audiovisual entrainment session, we can bring those back online. It's so cool.
To continue listening to this podcast, please go to voiceandsport.com and sign up for free as an athlete to join our community. Head over to minute 45 to hear the rest of this incredible conversation. Paige goes on to share some of the incredible results that athletes can gain from her therapy.
It's that trauma response and that sympathetic beta kind of gamma that keeps individuals from being in that flow. So when we look at the results, it's like they're loving it again, they're energized about it, they're sleeping well, they're not having as intense bouts of the anxiety.
She shares some ways we can calm our brain and prime it for performance at home.
I would advise individuals to put on their favorite music and their headphones. And so that will allow for the body to be kind of open and vulnerable and have the ability to kind of go through negative things because we want to have this kind of attuned or safe space, right?
And she explains all the incredible applications of performance neuro training for athletes and for everyone.
And then he started identifying certain conflicts or negative emotions that needed to be psychologically processed so that the cancer would go away. And he had this incredible success rate.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Viz creator Zosia Bullhawk, a track and cross-country athlete from the University of Houston. You can follow Paige on Instagram at Dr. Paige Roberts. If you liked our conversation with Paige, please leave us a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. It's super easy. Just scroll down to the bottom of the Voice and Sport podcast page on Apple Podcasts app and click on Leave a Review. Please click on the share button in this episode and send it to another athlete that you think might enjoy this conversation. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok at Voice and Sport. If you're interested in joining our community, sign up for free at voiceandsport.com to get started. When you join Voice and Sport, you gain access to our exclusive content and podcasts, mentorship sessions from professional athletes, and access to the top Viz experts in sports psychology and nutrition like Paige. If you're interested in more episodes starring Viz experts, check out episode number 93, where I talk to Dr. Stacey Sims about the misconceptions surrounding female physiology and our periods. You can access the full episode when you sign up at Voice and Sport and join our community. See you next week on the Voice and Sport podcast.